in person again for the long, since it's been a long time since we've done this. We've had a meeting, period. I'm just going to do a couple of quick updates from DMRC. And then the second thing on my agenda is, well, I'll explain it when I talk about the DMRC update. So as I think you all know from her email, Ellen Boland left the agency and went to work directly for the Secretary of Natural Resources. That's been a few months ago now. And of course, she was chairing the committee before. So what I'm hoping today is, my view is that most of these advisory committees, all of them as far as I know, pretty much, while they have a BMRC staff person, they're usually chaired by somebody on the committee. And I think that's appropriate here as well. After the update, I think we've had someone volunteer who would be willing to be chairman. We'll certainly open it up to anybody else that wants to volunteer. We'll always vote on it. But Beverly Ludford graciously called me this week, said she'd be willing to serve as the chairperson. After I finish my update, suitable to the group, go from there. With my acclamation, or nobody else wants it, it's default. You step, everybody takes 2 steps back, you're standing in the front. So, the only other update from BMRC I have is, and I announced this earlier, so some of you heard this already, the products board meeting, but the commissioner has approved the creation of the shellfish division at the agency. We don't have it at the moment. We have a fisheries division, a habitat division, law enforcement, and an admin and finance division. And we will, in the very near future, have a shellfish division that will be made up of the engineering surveying department, which is now currently within the habitat division, and the conservation and completion department, which is under the fisheries management division. We merge together into one unit. Everybody here preaching to the choir understands that engineering surveying at the agency has handled the private leasing system since the beginning of time. And we maintain the maps, and the maps of the public ground. What Andrew's program with conservation completion handles the public grounds, planting, surveys each year, the seasons. And we work together a lot. We're not even in the same division at the agency. I've said for years, it doesn't make a lot of sense. Finally got some traction on that. And hopefully, well, certainly no later than the end of this year, because Steve, the commissioner, as Bowman has said, he wants this completed and up and running before his term is up. He's made it very clear since he took the job again as commissioner a second time that he was not going to serve beyond the current governor's term. So he, sometime after first of the year, won't be commissioner. Of course, he'll serve until a replacement is named by the new administration. So with that, they've actually sent out the news ad for the chief position of the new division. That ends, the ad ends at the end of the month, and I assume that they'll schedule interviews up after that. We think soon thereafter that they'll advertise for the deputy as well. Those two positions, as far as I understand it, will be advertised to the public, so anyone can apply, it's qualified. And then once those are filled, then the chief and the deputy will then populate the division with existing personnel. We may have some managers, like an engineering manager and a conservation replenishment manager position, that will move some people around into the appropriate. My hope is that, you know, we'll get a division where we may even be able to give some people some raises that are grossly underpaid in the shellfish division and the conservation replenishment division. Andrew and I are probably both going to apply for the chief position, more than likely. I know I am. and then we'll see how it filters out from there. It's a little awkward because this idea was sold on no new positions, but getting a new position is like act of Congress. And of course you have funding for it. So if Andrew and I, one of us does not get one of these positions, the agency could be in somewhat of an awkward position of what do they do with the extra person they have now. I have a solution for that. I'll just retire. But But anyway, so we'll see how it goes. But anyway, that's just news that you might want to know. And I will continue to be, for now, as far as I know, and Andrew definitely helps me a lot, your staff person for BMRC. So I will still help with the logistics of Google polling the meetings and getting things set up and providing materials. But much like SMAC, you know, Andrew gives them the meat and potatoes of what the agency is doing, but they run their own meetings and have their own chair. So the chairperson. So with that, I'll stop talking and leave it up to the current committee as to what you think about designating a chairman or electing a chairman. Again, Beverly has graciously offered, so I'm going to turn it over to her if she wants to make a additional comment about it. There.
I decided after I saw the agenda, I thought about it. I went back through some history and all and decided that since I attended the first meeting and I've been here with you all pretty much faithfully that, and I have some experience in chairing advisory boards and in my 30-year public health career. Many of you know that already. And so I decided that I would volunteer to chair. And also, I think I'll learn more. And the chair, really, one of the jobs of the chair is, you know, to remain somewhat silent and objective and just keep order and go through the agenda and all that kind of thing. And, you know, I think I can do that. Be pretty fair and pretty flexible. I also have some ideas about the committee so that I'd like to put forward. If anybody else is interested in doing it, I think they should speak up. You know, let me know now, and you know, I'd be more than happy to let them do it. It's not like, you know, we'd have to have a runoff or anything. Is anybody else interested?
I think you'd be a fine chair. My only problem with what you just said is that you're going to be silent. Because I think you add a lot of value to our discussions. So I would hope you would not be silent.
Well, I think that, you know, we'll see how it goes. Sometimes you can say, well, I'm going to step out of the chair for a minute because I have an opinion about this, and then move back to the chair. I think that's reasonable. Robert's rule says, you know, you, and I see this a lot at BMRC, we're really, we're supposed to, if we do, we're supposed to say we're stepping out of the chair position and speaking to this particular issue and then going back to the chair. So I think because we have no chair right now, maybe we should say, you know, everybody in favor say aye.
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 Yay! Mark!
All right. Well,
congratulations on your election.
Thank you.
So I'll make one suggestion.
Okay.
Maybe you want to go ahead and select the vice chair right now, just in case you can't chair a meeting, then you'll have your backup already in place.
Okay, that's a good idea.
So you might want to just open the floor.
Anybody willing to vice chair with me?
Sure.
Mike Osterling has volunteered. Did anybody have any objections? Don't everybody speak at once. No. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Anybody opposed besides Mike? There you go. Back up. Vice chair. Back up. Thank you, Mike. I appreciate that. We've worked together a long time. I think we can do this. So looking at the agenda, item number 3, the review of pending proposed BMRC regulations. They were sent out with the notice of the meeting. If you don't have a hard copy, staff has a hard copy. Does anybody need a hard copy of these regulations?
I need a copy of the agenda, unless it's not very long.
Okay, everybody has a copy. So what we'll do, if it's okay with you all, everybody's in agreement, we'll go ahead and let staff talk about the first pending proposed BMRC regulation changes. And that would be the one of four. Is that the one you want to do first?
754.
12:30 will go a lot faster.
That's yeah. 12:30. I go 12:30.
Let's do 12:30. Let's do 12:30. So the way we do regulations, they're all four weight BAC, 20, and then 12:30 is that number is the unique number of regulations with BMRC. So that's why I call it 12:30. Mm-hmm. It's basically pertaining to restrictions and shelters is the title. So with that, I'm going to kind of turn this over to Andrew because Andrew's already vetted these with SBAC. And I'm going to give you a quick background on that. SBAC specifically, correct me if I'm wrong, has looked at both of these. And one of their comments was that they really thought AMAC should see it, knowing there is some overlap with some committee members. But my opinion is AMAC primarily is more geared to policing and HOSTA, and SMAC is traditionally going to be more about the public harvest. But there's overlap, and there's private leasehold overlap, both AMAC and SMAC, and water on both. So, anyway, regardless, we thought we'd get comments from both committees. I think Andrew may have SMAC leave one more time after this committee provides any comments on these two and coalesce on anything either committee has a concern about or thinks ought to be changed or suggestion, and then they'll get put on the commission agenda. I'll turn it over to Andrew to tell you what these two things mean, what we're trying to do
here. All right. Thanks for that introduction there. And I think with 1250, which is the pertaining to restrictions on shellfish, so the reasoning for it is BDH tracks closely working with the FDA.
1230.
Or 12:30. Yeah, sorry. 12:50 was the hanging rose. That was last month. 12:30. This regulation is really the main purpose of this is primarily your Vibrio control plan. So this is sort of the regulatory teeth behind our Vibrio control plan, which everyone's fairly familiar with, I imagine. And I think Ben had mentioned an email from AJ that had asked about the risk assessment, whether this was being based on that. Basically, the Vibrio control plan is formulated based on a risk assessment done based on time, temperature control, water temperature, basically, and also your risk sort of preserving, basically your risks of Vibrio go into that calculation. And what the science is showing based on Virginia Department of Health is water's getting warmer, air's getting warmer. I think last year, October 1st, the first day of public oyster season, it was 90 degrees. So the data isn't there yet to definitively say that we have to make this change. It's not going to be mandated coming down through ISSC FDA, but it's likely close to that point. So the purpose of this is sort of get ahead of that, so we're not sort of caught flat-footed and have to make a snap change or be found out of compliance or worst case scenario, actually start having folks getting sick, which is really the whole main reason behind this, that sort of collective protection for the whole industry is Vibrio meningitis. Even when it's no one's fault, it gets in the news and it's not exactly good for anybody. I have some personal experience with it. My dad lost his finger to Vibrio meningitis 2 years ago, actually caught the infection 3 days ago, 2 years ago today. So right there in the York River. But not from oysters, just a cut on his finger and water. But anyway, serious stuff. But the main change in this is just extending everything that happened in the month of September, which is your noon harvest curfew. All land-based deliveries of oysters need to be in temperature controlled devices. Everything that was going on in September is the whole changes in this regulation are chasing that date, changing from September 30th to October 31st throughout the regulation. There really isn't any substantive change other than adding a month to our warm water harvest restrictions because of the fact that it'll likely be coming in the relatively near future, if not mandated next year, probably shortly thereafter. And let's look at this a little bit ahead of that. And that's that's really the main meat of it. I think also in AJ's email there, Ben, he mentioned.
Yeah. Let me
go ahead and jump across.
So the meat of the change is on page 4 of 8. Everywhere else, we're just substituting from May 1 to October 31st to September 30th. But there are different times based on the time of what month it is. And Andrew's right. We're just going to make it September through October. So it's the 12 noon time that used to only apply to September. Will now be September and October. We're just adding October to the 12 noon time. So the questions that AJ said, he said, can't be here, but he has a couple of questions, concerns. He did ask, was the risk calculator, which is the way ISSC assesses how to implement these kind of rules, being used to recommend the October? If not, how is it made? I think Andrew's answered that already. That says yes. That's how we come up with it. The second one was, if October is included, then watermen working public ground will be subject to the regulations, which depend on the gear type, may be physically difficult to implement shade cover. And Andrew and I had a brief conversation about that. And said, well, they're going to have to figure that out because they're going to have to do it. And shading is not that difficult. I understand the mechanical equipment. There might be some adaptation. What do you say about that?
Private ground harvest, clam harvest, people dredge. Dredge all summer long with shade over. I think the main concern that did come up a little bit at SMAC was hand tongers. And that could be maybe a little bit awkward, but most people are pretty, you have a roll-up shade, you have two pieces of grab pot line, you roll it up in your tonga and keep your pile in the shade. So it should be not hugely cost prohibitive to figure out a way to keep some shade on your oysters. Nicing is also an option too. So it should be that didn't come up with that snack meeting about it'd be hard to hand on the shade. But again, it's 12 noon and a lot of these guys are done at that point. Actually, this year, the entire season, the hand spring season is going to end at 12 noon. Anyway. So you would be going past the part of the spring.
What was the last thing that you said? What did you, what was the last thing you just said kind of trailed off?
That this year, actually, the harvest times for the public oyster harvest season for hand scrape, which is the most popular gear type, the harvest time, typically seasons pass then at 2 p.m. Most people are back at the dock now so early, I mean, 9, 10 o'clock with their limit, that I don't think that should be an issue in terms of the curfew. So the shading, which folks have figured out how to do dredge-wise just fine, shouldn't be too much of an issue. I think the main concern is might be a little bit trickier with some of the hand tongers to have the full lock set up. But I mean, there's, you don't have to have a full lock. Full appreciation.
So his third question was, when will this go into effect? Next year.
October 1st of 2022, I think. 2022.
And the last thing is,
okay.
Are there any questions for staff about this at all? I don't know, but you can tell me that this is not going to go before the commission next week.
No, it'll, like I said,
it'll be out.
We'll take any comments you have of the back to SBAC. It won't take effect for next year, so I don't know what Andrew's thinking time frame. What when you put it on the agenda, probably not good.
We want to do it. Usually to save certain advertising costs, we'll try to roll it in if we're doing another oyster rig. So if it's ready to go and it's been heard, and if we can take the implementation rig at the same time, probably try to do it both together.
So, can't be this one.
No, probably, but I guess no, the joint meeting in November and December would probably be maybe more October. Potentially.
Another announcement. I forgot. The commissioner did say last week that there won't be a November meeting. Typical with the fall right around Thanksgiving. And the December meeting will be 14th, Tuesday. Not the third Tuesday, it's the second Tuesday.
14th.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So this goes back to SMAC before it goes in front of the commission.
Mm-hmm. Probably the earliest would be November or October, I guess. Would be
possible. Yeah, October.
For the record, I think it would be good if we had a motion to send this back to SMAC, and after they've reviewed it, we don't send any recommended changes back to them. Is that in order?
I'd like to move that AMAC give our approval to the changes to 4 VAC 20-12-30, changing the summer harvest end date to October 31.
Is there a second?
A second.
Just as a comment, health department's going to do this.
Well, I got a comment. I think it's a good incremental change. But probably last year, I hope. May come a day, and you got to relook it in September. I hope not.
Right.
Temperatures keep going up. Anyway, I think it's a good incremental change.
All in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? There you go. All right. You want to talk about the next one?
Sure. The next one is titled Pertaining to Importation of Fish Shellfish or Crustacea. And this is what we call Regulation 754. This one has a number of changes. See the little thing at the top? There's nomenclature issues, I guess.
That was just a note that was in there when I pulled the original out, so I figured I'd leave it in there so it didn't get missed.
Okay. That's a housekeeping thing. But anyway, who needs a copy of this? By the way, we have another BMRC person here.
Oh.
All right. She's in habitat, but she has as Randy says, a sick interest in oyster issues. So she's agreed to be some assistance to us at the staff level, and I appreciate you coming in the office. I didn't get to talk to her yesterday. She was, I think I feel completely well.
Well, Andrew, before you start, I have to bring up and just say that if you'll notice on this, that this apparently has not been amended since 2002.
Yep.
So we're talking 19 years ago. And that's a long time.
Yep.
Go ahead, Andrew. What happened the last 19 years?
Well, I'll give a little bit of background and then ask Ryan and any of the, or Mark or Karen here to fill in the gaps there. But I guess the sort of high level view of this is the intended changes. The intent of the changes is to go from a zero tolerance policy, which is what we currently have in regulation on your endemic diseases to this area. So primarily dermo MSX and UPX, which right now, if there's any detectable disease in any shellfish that are required to be batch sampled prior to importation, basically outside the Chesapeake Bay and Delaware Bay watershed, that the BMRC by regulation we pretty much say no. So we have, even though I'm not sure what our endemic infection rates are, but higher than what's like 6, 12, 15, 20% higher in some areas, is out there everywhere basically at this point, except probably some of your very, very low salinity areas, most of the oysters died in 2018. But anyway, so basically, the intent of these changes are to take that zero tolerance policy and sort of adjust it, sort of allow a little bit of those natural diseases that we have here already in, to hopefully the intent is to encourage folks to get their shellfish tested, to make sure that we're not being an impediment to industry who wants to potentially bring seed in from other areas and sort of take away the temptation to say, I know there's going to be a little bit of disease. I'm just going to take it in. I'm not really going to do anything. We do know that it's happening. So hopefully this allows, by allowing a little bit of that disease in sort of at background levels, will encourage those folks to go ahead and get those disease either batch tested. Or the other major change in this regulation is to allow hatcheries to become certified for annual testing so that, you know, basically if it's a known area, they're consistently getting their oysters or clam seed tested. They're always at that low level of prevalence. They would be part of that program and you wouldn't require batch testing, sort of saving everyone time, money, and sort of more importantly, freeing up shellfish pathologists to actually look for non-endemic diseases, something new, something novel, something that we really don't want in our waters, really rather than looking for what we already have. So it seems like you're actually being, you know, allowing a little bit of risk or actually preventing larger risk, sort of the paraphrase of what's in here. Go ahead.
I'm sure, I think everybody understands how we do regulation for BMRC, but anything is stricken, obviously we're taking out. Anything is underlined, new. Okay. So anything you see here that's underlined is new language, which obviously stuff is being struck.
Yeah. And I'll just kind of walk through the changes there for the collective good. And then if there's any questions, I'll probably defer to Ryan, Mark, or Karen there. So the definition section, sort of this is a sort of a real important one is we're adding the term clinical disease. So you'll see that replacing some of the other zero tolerance language. But that definition is basically endemic Perkinsus Halosaurian pathogens or PPX that exceeds 5% prevalence in a sample and or with any single infection of moderate or greater intensity. So basically if something's really infected, we're still going to say no. But if it's sort of a light infection and only 5% of your 60 clams or oysters that are being tested has it, then we'd allow that in. So that's a safe number, that 5% is sort of below our background levels. And also, I think it fits in with what you're sort of seeing in most of these batch tests, usually sort of 2 or 3% is kind of what's hanging people up in a lot of these cases. The northern broodstock, that's a little bit of a change. So that line was sort of at South Carolina, I think, before. So we're moving that to Virginia. Here it is north. So basically any of the hatchery produced seed has to be from northern broodstocks. Again, by code, we're required to consult with the Virginia Institute of Marine Science, specifically the director or his designee in this case. So added a definition of what VIMS means in terms of this regulation. And I guess the other, most of that's just for cleaning up language in that next section 1A there. But again, adding the clinical disease versus no pathogens there. I did make the change about Pacific coastal states there. So it's just for clarifying that. But basically, this would mean no hatchery produced seed from any Washington, California, those areas there for hard clams.
Where does Hawaii fall in this?
I think by the way the regulation is currently written, it would be allowable, I think, for Hawaii. We can change that if there's a concern there, I guess.
That was what started all this. Clam seed was going to be imported from Hawaii to Chicoutimi.
I think it was actually post barrier seed.
I think it's
Pacific Coastal includes Hawaii. So the way that I'm reading that now, I know I've gone back and forth, but that's the intent. And we say, is that from a pathology perspective, we want to exclude Hawaii?
I think so. I mean, we struggle a little bit with that because, I mean, Hawaii had that. It was a special circumstance.
Right.
They were bringing up very, very deep water that wouldn't necessarily have had the same pathogen risk, but it's an unknown. And it originally was not permitted 20 years ago because it was such an unknown. We just had no idea.
And hitchhiker issues.
Yeah, but that would be an issue. And I think it would be safe to have Pacific Coastal encompass Hawaii for the purpose.
If that is indeed the attempt, may want to be more specific than just Pacific and.
Well, I think that, yeah, any hard clam, the way I'm reading it there, within Connell, which is absent, and then it goes on, except that any importation of hatchery produced seed from Pacific coastal states. So it doesn't say continental for there. So
okay. I got a suggestion. Why don't you, things like this, definitions do a lot of good. It's just to put it in the definition. Pacific coastal means name the states.
Right.
Then you're done. That's clear. I mean, what's put there where you want to read is if you want to lie in or out. Mm-hmm. Throw that out. Then it's clear and you know what it means.
And be consistent with planned voice.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Because you're excluding it and but you're allowing it. So unless there's a reason that you can have a difference between clam and oysters, it should be, this, I would think, again, I'm not up on my shellfish diseases, but if you don't allow it for clams, it seems weird that you don't allow it, for, even if it's the size.
Yeah. So, and you're referring to this point three, down further below the 15 millimeter and under. But it does read as if Super Jimco would be allowed in. I can't see why that would be a good idea.
Well, that would, yeah, that section would be just change, add both species to that first one.
I'm a little bit, and I'll state this. This makes me extremely nervous. I've always been nervous about importation, especially with, I'm okay with the state of Dermo and FSX, but any the unknown factor, because we've been so good for decades here, just bringing in from others just makes the sky is falling. But having that on now coming in just makes me super nervous with all the diseases. I don't know if you can solve my nerves or not.
Well, I think my response to that would be that Andrew really captured the rationale very well. Like, we think that if we relax the stringency with regard to control of MSX, Dermo, QPX, like that we know are absolutely everywhere. Yeah, and allow just a little bit more of that in, a little bit of a freer flow, that we could bring more people into the fold that are presently bypassing the process because they know that they're going to get tripped up by that one positive, that one rare.
How much do you see? Like, I guess it would help me with this regulation, accepting it, is understanding how much is being imported and from where, like, and then if you do have, like, an idea of people are skirting them all, then give me some little bit of background. But, like, how much is this an issue? Like, how many permits? You don't have to tell me who's bringing in, but can you tell me where it's coming from and where you're getting the red flags and saying no? I had that information before reading this. You know, I'm reading regulations blind from last week. If I had a little bit more background on, hey, we get so many import, so many people wanted this seed certified. Because it's also a gray area of who it falls on. Yeah. Like, if who's bringing it in is required. So it's not the hatchery from out of state required. It's the person buying the seed is supposed to be, and I'm not familiar with it, so correct me if I'm wrong. The person buying the seed out of state is supposed to contact you to get the certification. Or is it the hat, unless they are under a program?
Well, I guess try to walk the process right now. Is anyone wanting to import the seed has to both submit a pathology report certifying zero disease, and ask for that report to BMRC. So they have to sort of initiate the process.
Through you, through BMRC, not with Ryan.
Yeah, not with Ryan. So it has to come to the commission. And most of what we get is mostly folks who are doing either conditioning south, moving stuff back and forth, or we get very few actual import requests for 500,000 small seed. We don't get those very often. Most of the import requests are hatchery folks moving stuff back and forth. A lot of that. We're not getting a ton of requests for a lot of small seed, and part of the reason for that is probably because a lot of that small seed is probably going to have the background levels. I know that it's coming in. I talked to growers and hear what's going on. So we're probably, I don't have a good percentage of how much is coming in with an import permit, but we don't get very many requests for import permits. But I think sort of from the talk, there's probably a lot more that's coming in.
And is it rated down by species, clams or oysters? Or
most of the, it's probably about a 50-50 split in terms of clams and oysters. A lot of the clams are, I say more oysters than clams most of the times. I don't have the numbers right, but we're probably dealing with maybe 20 or 30 import permits a year would be a high-end estimate. And a lot of it's just, the same folks doing small batches or whatever it is. It's not a huge amount, but I think there's probably, again, I'm just sort of guessing based on talk and hearsay, that there's probably at least that much or more so coming in from that probably should have been disease sensitive.
And we're still going to be looking. It's just a matter of there's a slightly higher tolerance, but we're still looking at everything, and we're looking for emerging pathogens. The only sort of change to what we would be looking at would be the hatchery certification aspect of things, which is the program that I'm sure you heard Karen talk about before. So we wouldn't necessarily be looking at batches every time with that aspect of the regulation model, but we're actually through the hatchery certification, where I think we make an improvement is that we're actually going to be looking at sort of the size category, the type of product that would be moving, rather than something like 3 weeks earlier. It's a very different, a smaller, inside the hatchery rather than out at the nursery. It's a very different product when it's much younger. So, I think this is a blind spot a bit. I think with the seed, the small seed stuff right now, with the batch certification model, we look at everything, and we look at everything where somebody asks us to, but we're looking at stuff, a month before it travels. So we don't really have a good sense of what actually it's going to look like at the time it travels. And what hatchery certification is doing is systematically profiling through, two or three times a year analyses of that facility, what that stuff is going to look like that they are going to be routinely moving. And that sets the maximum size that they can move within the certification. Everything else has to be smaller and less safer, less likely to be exposed. So that itself there, it's sort of like paradoxical. It feels like we're doing less work and we're making things less secure and we're paying less attention, but actually we're applying the effort a bit differently to greater effect, to get a better handle on what the risks are regarding these facilities. And I should say also that they're really minimal. Like we have hundreds of analyses that we've done, like coastwide, looking at hatcheries, and we see literally nothing in the context of any of these hatcheries, because you're all doing a great job of managing your water quality. For whatever filtration and UV treatment and so on that you're doing, there's just nothing getting in. So, and that's where the hatchery certification is. So, I hope that's an additional, I was helpful to the additional background.
I feel what we do is so fragile that it can be changed at any moment. We talk about harmful algal blooms. I mean, they happen north of us, they happen south of us. And, you know, so there's so much that can come in with an importation that can crash our system. And again, I'm a Debbie, I'm the, one of the most nervous people, especially during hurricane season, so it's not helping having this discussion. But again, with everything that an animal that can concentrate, stating that I'm nervous about having it.
But that exact sentiment is the fundamental motivation for the whole thing.
Right.
The pathology community has looked at our framework for keeping these animals healthy and these businesses safe from disease outbreaks, and we're like, we're just not set up to succeed, you know, and something's going to come along and reveal the flaws in the system, and we need to tighten this up. And so. It looks like we're heading not in the right direction, but we really are. Relaxing the tolerance is to try to encourage more businesses to join the program, you know, come through the labs so we can see what's going on is going to be beneficial.
So how many have you denied? Like, how much has been, like, so obviously we're changing it because people have been denied, correct? Is that what's going on?
Well, I think what happens is if they get a pathology report, especially if they've been denied once, I rarely see pathology reports that aren't clean. I just recently saw one and I said no. So I think you don't get those applications. Usually they'll get tested first, or they'll contact me and I'll say, you know, you have to get tested. It has to have zero. So you don't necessarily get those applications if they would be denied. So I think in those cases, we don't have a good idea whether they said no, I'm not bringing those. I don't have the follow up to go search through and figure out if they did import it or not. But I suspect probably some people don't, and I would suspect that some people do, or some people don't even go through the process because they've done it once or twice before, have 2 or 3% prevalence. Know they would get denied and either go somewhere else or bring them to see them.
So what I'm hearing so far is that at the bottom of page 2, third line from the bottom, this group wants to change the wording to from Pacific coastal states and Hawaii.
Either that or add a definition of what a Pacific coastal state is.
Okay. Okay. It's going to get warmer.
Alaska, Hawaii.
I think we probably don't really address international. I think there's other stuff that says no to that at the MRC.
So the group goes on record. AJ asked the question, and it's very similar to your concerns, Ann. I'm just going to read this. I think we've discussed it some already, but his last concern with this regulation was disease reports on imported seed. I always have a concern about new diseases being introduced. I'm in favor of streamlined paperwork, but I feel more comfortable when batch testing is occurring on seed imports, parentheses, assuming the importer is complying with the current regulations. So that was just his sort of comment, not really a question. But I want to get it on the record of the meeting.
With a little bit of a pause, Madam Chair, this is Mark. May I make a comment or two?
Yep, go ahead, Mark.
Okay. An apology. I haven't been able to hear. I've been able to get the context, but not all the details necessarily of what Ann said. So I won't. Go into great detail. I do want to say just a little bit high level on background. Ryan, with Karen and others, and pathologists along the East Coast and to some extent the Gulf, have been working on and discussing this topic for years. We are most concerned about anything that's going to negatively impact the industry. That's at the environment, and that's the center of this. And Ryan won't say it, so I will. He's leading this charge. He's the most credible voice on this topic on the Eastern Gulf Coast. And this is about, honestly, it is about reducing risk to the industry. And we, and VIMS broadly feel strongly about this. I feel kind of lucky. It's fortunate that it's one of those things where reducing risk to the industry seems to entail less burden on the industry, which is nice. That's not always the way our recommendations come out. But this less testing, less paying for, less rejecting of seed because there's a small amount of dermo or MSX in it, which we know doesn't matter. To me, it's a great confluence of paying really close attention to the environmental concerns, what we honestly believe collectively, not only at VIMS, but I can tell you Ryan's colleagues throughout the Eastern Gulf Coast believe this, is really important for reducing risk to the industry. And it's just really cool that it's like less burden on the industry. So that's my only comments.
Okay, someone likes to tell us what he said.
He said Ryan's right.
Listen to Ryan, who likes you all.
Was my audio that bad?
Yeah. There we go. Yeah, now you're coming through the speakers over the table.
Welcome.
You know, there's one other point I'll just make is that we're trying to make some changes to the way things are structured, but we're pushing for this and all the other states too, and the Virginia hatcheries are going to benefit. You know, if we create more harmony among regulations across the East Coast states and reduce, you know, some of this, you know, move away from the zero tolerance model, that's going to promote more opportunities for Virginia hatcheries to sell their products. Because that is, I mean, I don't see as much of sort of the incoming stuff that Andrew sees, but I see a lot of the problems with the outgoing stuff, where there's, you know, I mean, it's, you know, 20 millimeter or, you know, half inch, you know, nursery seed that somebody wants to move to North Carolina or somewhere that's got like a single dermo cell and it gets hung up, which just doesn't make any sense at all. So we're trying to sort of harmonize everything, you know, increase the tolerances slightly so that things can move a little bit more easily. But we're not looking at less product.
So is there COVID variants and Delta and all this? So is there any difference between Perkinsus and MSX? So, is there any variance? Like, does the Florida variant or the North Carolina variant is different than Virginia's? Or has
virulence.
Yeah, you know, I mean, that's a great question, man. And you know, that's.
So you're saying,
yeah.
You know, exposure is you know,
yeah.
Percentages are percentages, but is there any difference between the southern thermal or our thermal or different states?
I think the answer would be that, you know, we don't presently have any reason to think that they're, you know, like, I mean, if we were talking about, and this is why we're, you know, we would not be in favor of like Gulf to Atlantic movements, because there probably is a different Perkinsus there. And then, you know, all kinds of other stuff that we have no idea about, because nobody's looking very closely to Gulf. But within the Atlantic,
so those western side of Florida, where there's hatcheries, right?
Yeah.
So is that going to come to Virginia if that's the Gulf of Mexico, right? So and here you would open that up.
With regard to oysters or clams?
I'm just throwing out the conversation.
It's a good conversation.
Yeah, because I don't think the intention is to have.
But it's coastal state, so you're opening up Florida, the coastal state. Aren't the hatcheries on the west coast?
Well, Florida's got, but they're carefully controlling what's moving between the coasts within Florida.
Are they? You're opening up to allow Florida to bring seed up here.
From the Atlantic.
Yeah, it's Pacific, it's Mid-Atlantic, South Atlantic.
So not the West Coast of Florida.
It's East Coast.
Okay, I'm just saying that East, as long as it's clear that it's the East Coast of Florida, not the West Coast of Florida.
Again, I'm just reading regulations, throwing it out there.
Well, that's not real. On the next page, on page 3 or 4, in these bullets, A, B, C, D, it says, you know, the hatchery. It doesn't say, you know, it doesn't say the East Coast hatchery.
But it says it in the definition of northern breedstock.
Yeah.
But I was just assuming East Coast of the United States, not the East Coast of Florida, right?
Isn't the East Coast of Florida on the East Coast of Florida?
Yeah, but I meant, but they're saying that the West Coast of Florida is being excluded.
Yeah, that's the way I read it.
Yeah, I think it is.
Well,
right? Okay, so I'm just moving along here to page 4. The question was asked earlier about item 2. Why the reduction from 25 to 15 millimeters?
So that was because that was to align the sort of the distinction between smaller product and bigger product with where we have data. Now, so that, I mean, since we talked about that maybe a half an hour ago, and we started the meeting or longer ago. You know, so I was looking more closely at what we have here, and you know, there's not a ton of difference between 15 and 25 millimeters, but I think the idea with moving to 15 was to more fully sort of align the regulation with the hatchery certification model, which would be exclusively limited to under.
And only oyster.
And that's clams. Well, that is an oyster session.
Right.
But hatchery certification could apply to clams.
And on the next page, that's
there's not a change to.
Now it says it's 25%. Let me back it up.
Yeah. Just asking.
I think.
To D15?
I mean, it's 15, it's 25 for everything else. It's been 25 across the board.
Right.
So I think Mike's question to me earlier was, when you made the point that there's a reason why it's 25 with regard to ISSB and so on. So, I mean, I think the question might be whether we might not be better off using 25. The problem I see with the only potential sort of hang up I see right now with moving it to 25 is I think we, on page 4 under item 3, the less than 15 or it's less than 25, there we do say, you know, any coastal area or state within the continental United States. So particularly if we're increasing that size range to where we're going to be moving into more nursery animals near the higher end of that range.
The way I read it, though, we're decreasing it from
25
to
25. Yeah.
So you're decreasing.
Well, I decreased it because in revising the text, you know, to sort of incorporate the hatchery certification and so on, it made more sense at 15. And it was cleaner, I think, relative to the existing language that we had in there about, you know, where these waters were, continental United States, and so on. 25 millimeters is a big oyster to have been on raw water and then to be trapped.
Okay, that's the reason then.
So I think that you know, if we do want to stay at 25, which may be cleaner, and I'm not sure what that answer is. I think then maybe we want to make sure that we're not bringing stuff in from outside the Atlantic coast.
Well, I think that's sort of the distinction there is sort of once you're when you're under that 15 millimeter size, most of that's going to be not raw water throughout for a long time. Correct me if I'm wrong, Ryan, but the longer it's in the system, the more likely it is to pick up any pathogens in the background. This is stuff that's come from a closed system, maybe being in, maybe a little bit of flow through for a matter of maybe 2-3 weeks. And 15 millimeters doesn't take long. We always used to get to that size, whereas 25 millimeters, that's another 2 weeks, 30 days. That's a lot more time to pick up any of those pathogens. I think it's sort of good.
But not so with the other species.
I can understand the risk rationale in reducing it to 15. And Andrew will show me other regulations where seed is defined at 25 millimeters. I'll be happy.
It's not defined at 25 millimeters in other regulations. It's defined at larger than that.
Okay.
We have a couple different, and then there's seed stock shellfish, which we have a size, it's a time.
Yeah.
But that gets into other oyster gray areas, not necessarily. Yeah.
And more regulations we need to fix.
Okay, so we're moving now, we're leaving at 15. Does everybody agree that we had an explanation that makes us understand that? Then we're moving to page 5.
Sorry, these are 5 or 4. When you expand these by adding new language,
right,
that gets corrected.
Yeah. I was a little confused about that.
Yeah.
When I was I have some change. What do we need?
I don't know why. I guess when you take out all the double spacing and everything, it might sort of go.
It brings it back to what it wished to be.
Right.
But when you add more pages, instead of saying 5 or 5, 4 or 5, 5 or 6, you know.
I think it's right now. Yeah, this breakout
might be a word. That
I think it's.
Does anybody have any issues about this page, page 5? Just page 5.
How much other species besides clams and oysters is covered?
I'm not sure what Brian sees, but occasionally I'll get something for bay scallops. I haven't seen any surf plant, any soft shell plant, or any bulk peelers in at least 7 years. So I'm not sure before that if there was much. I don't think.
So again, this says any coastal area within the continent of the United States.
Well, I guess that's. I mean, we can define that, but if there's, it sounds like I have a list of questions here. Are there areas that we definitely don't want anything coming from? And that's right now my understanding is the Pacific coastal states, we want nothing coming from there, but we're okay at this point with, so that isn't necessarily clear. So we could change that.
So it's Pacific, we didn't want the Gulf of Mexico either.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really the question is right now the way that it would read regulatory language is the 15 millimeter CE even from Gulf Coast would be okay. I think we're kind of okay with that, but not necessarily a larger size.
Sam seed doesn't have any size on H2.
So there isn't currently a specific size on our plant.
You're seeing importations.
I think one of the reasons for that was that when this was written, there was still a relay program of large clams from South and North Carolina coming into Virginia.
That still does happen a little bit. But it's not a huge market, but it is very kind of that.
Which I'm kind of, again, I'm okay with. Okay, I get it, especially with the same percentage of prevalence. But I don't know if I'm okay with any size plant seed coming from the Gulf of Mexico. That's where I'm.
So, I mean,
is there much interest in bringing among the Virginia industry? And
maybe not
gold?
Next year.
I've seen Florida plates coming past my hatchery, and you know where my hatchery is.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
People, and there's Florida people that will stop by and ask if I want to buy seed or whatever. So there's people, you know, trolling. I call them trollers, and I try to avoid them. But I'm in a pretty isolated spot, especially where my hatchery is. Over the bridge, no labels, no nothing. And they're still fine. So I think, again, I still think West Coast, Florida, if they have a good year, they're going to be around. And that doesn't seem nervous.
I think that we should make a point of using the same language, not saying, they're saying it has to be on the East Coast.
Well, I guess the might take a little bit of rosemary wordsmithing, but I think right now we could add a hatchery produced seed section for clams, have a minimum size. Might be, so we don't have that now, so this includes wild and everything. Here, if it's not coming from the hatchery. So we could have a separate section that if it's hatchery produced, it has to be under a certain size. And that would get at the concern of the Gulf Coast. So basically, are folks be following me on that? So that if we have, say, a minimum shell height or length for clams, I guess, of 25 millimeters, if it's coming from a hatchery produced seed, that we could allow that from, say, coastal waters in the Gulf, within that safety range, where we wouldn't be allowing any larger seed, or we just don't want to allow it at all in terms of both.
Do we feel like we should leave the possibility open of Gulf imports at all?
And that's, I guess, the real question. Right?
I mean, from my perspective, that's the stuff that I'm the most uneasy about. And that's what we all worry about within the pathology community, because we just don't have enough information on what's going on in Gulf of Mexico. Because there's been so little pathology done over the years there. And it's hard to make the same argument that, well, the water's just, slosh it up and down the, I mean, everything in the Atlantic, dermo and MSX, and there's a homogenization of what's in one place is as far north and south as it can go within its temperature limitations, basically. But the Gulf is a whole different game, and there could be other stuff going on that we just have no idea about. And then we could think about, the kinds of things that could be in a hatchery system that wouldn't be in open water, viruses and stuff. And we just have no idea.
Absolutely. I think we should err on the side of caution, given, as we all know, how fragile things are. So I think what I'm hearing is everybody hearing the same thing. We don't want to include the Gulf.
I'm okay with East Coast.
I'm okay. I would be okay with excluding the Gulf.
And the Pacific.
And the Pacific, yeah.
The West Coast, the Gulf State Coast.
Does that create a complication that we're not thinking of?
And we don't have to vote on this today.
Yeah. No, we're sending
it. Florida's got voted this.
Do they have hatcheries on the East Coast?
There are a couple.
What's that?
Is there
anything? No, not right now. For this regulation.
East Coast.
I mean, it's the only question is really Florida.
We just want to make sure that it's clear that it's the East Coast of the United States.
Yeah.
So instead of continental United States, it's East Coast.
We'd probably use that New England, Mid-Atlantic, or South Atlantic coastal areas or states. I mean, to have something that basically says we're not allowing importation from anywhere other than just coastal. I mean, that's,
I would go back to the definition.
Yes.
And again, I can chew on it. You can throw something out, but I'm still, my hat, I'm almost okay if we limit it to the East Coast, but a lot of my hackles, you know, it creates a smaller zone of possibilities. Because there's not that much going on the East Coast side.
Well,
I mean, up north, but that's a whole
thing. And I guess the other sort of regulatory question is do we want to allow importation just none at all from those areas or none at all if even regardless of testing? I mean, so that's the
well, earlier question. I heard none at all from California, Washington. I mean, we're none at all.
Right. Okay. Just want to make sure that's clear. Is there, I mean, it sounds like there's pretty good science to back that up for the most part there. So it sounds like that's out of abundance of caution. These are the proof areas. That's sort of where we lean on the bench for is we should lean on you all for the actual list of approved areas and approved species. So if you don't have any heartburn for that, then it's erring on the side of caution. I think we can write the regulation in a way that makes it pretty clear.
And I, you know, I mean, I suppose in 15 years, you know, when there's a lot more action withdrawals, and we have a much better idea of what's going on, and we realize that this was overly cautious and there really is no risk, then we have to be revisited. But it does seem prudent now to be able to.
And do you scan
for
the algae? Can
we
scan for
abs? No. I mean, there could be all kinds of stuff. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that you want on the radar.
She's really not going to sleep tonight.
I'm sleeping.
But you know, I mean, but you know, working, you know, the long history we have of work on the Atlantic, like we have a good handle of what's where in terms of pathogens and risks and hazards to culture production. I mean, problems that were, you know, I mean, we have relationships with the hatcheries and the nurseries and so on. Like we have a good handle on what's going on. We just don't outside the region.
Now, I think that to me is just a clear statement, and you all have said this, and I'm kind of summarizing what I'm hearing, is that there's just not enough information, data, or it's the unknown that could really be a problem.
And again, I know on the soapbox, but you see like the herpes virus, how quickly it comes in and it devastates an industry within weeks. We saw it with our local oyster decades ago, but it's still something that happens on a fairly recent basis of disease. So opening it up, so I'm conservative because it happens so much and so quickly that I don't want to be out of business. I just don't have to. I have a couple decades yet to work. So maybe in 15 years we can look at opening it up. But right now I'm on guard all the time for something like this.
Yeah.
Especially because you just said you don't screen for even halves. So
well,
like,
I mean,
you think we should be like going? I get it for not screening for MSX and Dermo, but I feel like we should be screening for more. Like, not only I don't want to be shut down because of shellfish mortality, I don't want to get shut down for HABs either. I mean, West Coast gets shut down, Maine gets shut down. I don't want to get shut down. We're in this little bubble that happens. North Carolina happens north of us, but thankfully it's not happening here yet. Okay, I'm done.
We're going to send this to back to AMAC too. Looking at now, we're moving to page 6, and we're changing within 60 days to within 30 days. And you or anyone give us some insight into why that 60 days is being reduced to 30 days.
I can do a little bit. So this is coming back a little bit more to batch testing. Again, so once you get started outside of the certification program there, And again, I guess most of these species can do a lot of growing in that 30 days. And I think, again, this is erring more on the side of caution,
okay.
Particularly with, you know, all these permits that used to be probably a lot more than were being actually mailed in 2002 than they are now. Almost all of this is a PDF going back and forth. So there's a lot less turnaround time on the paper on this thing. So again, you know, 30 days, that's a 50 millimeter oyster, and then 30 days later, or 60 days later at this point, that could be, you know, an inch and a half or pretty close to that.
Longer exposure to the water.
Exactly.
Yes, 30 days less exposure to raw water.
All right. So are there any other comments that we would like to make to send back to AMAT?
Yes. I'd like to go back to page 3 or 4.
Okay.
This is a problem that we've had for years. Under D, who approves the shellfish pathologist?
Right now, it's mostly BMRC. So if we get anything from Truva, if it looks like it is us, so basically we'll get a pathology report. And if there's anything unusual about it, there's no written protocol, there's no written list of approval. It's just we'll look. We'll call them, look up to see what they're actually doing. Talk to Ryan or the venous pathologist and say, have you heard of these folks? But it really hasn't been a huge issue in terms of getting fishing looking reports. Or sort of, a lot of them come through Ryan's lab, but in terms of we want a regulated list of approved or specify what the approval is.
Someone will bring that up. So why don't you just say a BMRC approved shellfish pathologist. That could be you calling Ryan and Ryan say, yes, I vouch for him.
That, I think we talked a little bit about that. I think it sort of implies it's a BMRC regulation that would be us, but having it in there, there's no reason not to be clear when you
right.
Mention
that. That adds the certified statement from a BMRC approved shellfish pathologist.
I understand the spirit too. If we had some compliance or some MOI both between states, making it easier to transfer seed, I get that. I would like that because that would open up more for me too. So I don't want to shoot myself in the foot, but even from my perspective, exporting it would be an issue, you know, like. I would love to see it work, but I want to make sure it works coming in.
I think that's the goal of the Hatcher certification program.
And I remember being at BIMS talking about the exact same thing. So it's been in the works for years trying to figure out the Hatcher certification.
Have a list of approved hatcheries so far, or is there a list? Is there anyone who's actually would qualify under this regulation at this point outside of the state?
For approved pathologists?
Yeah.
No, for approved hatcheries.
We
did pilot a program and we have 3 hatcheries in Virginia that are approved, but obviously it would be importing to Virginia. And we have 1 Maine, Mooksy Farm in Maine, who went through the now it would have to be recertified. The certification has to be authorized each year, so they would have to be recertified. So only 1 out-of-state hatchery currently under the program. But again, that would, you know, if these were to go forward and that hatchery were to get re-upped, which I don't see why not, reapproved, then that would be the immediate personal thing.
Send this back to AMAC. With the recommendations from this committee.
Send it back. We'll take a look at, probably take it to regulatory review and work on that. Maybe then bring it to SNAC.
Yep.
I think we'll beat it up a little bit.
Did they have
incorporate
issues? Did SNAC have issues? Did SNAC look at this? Did they have issues with this?
Their issues were they wanted this group to look at it and then take another crack at it once they had a chance at it. I think there was a little bit more concern with the warm weather harvest. forest, at least at SNAC, but I think not much. And I think this one, they seem to be more okay with the, they didn't get into the same level of detailed discussion as this group is. So I think overall they were supportive of the idea, but not so much the nuts and bolts that we're getting into sort of this. So they had sort of talked about having a working group for both of those, and then sort of that's where the AMAC would be the work. There's so much overlap that we're sharing.
So I'm looking for a motion to send this to AMAC with the recommendations that we have made. SMAC. Thank you. SMAC, looking for a motion.
I'd like to move that VMRC review language trying to incorporate the suggestions from AMAC, and then it be forward to SMAC for their review.
Second.
Any discussion on that? All in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? Is there any new business? Anybody would like to break down? Well, I would like to recommend, I don't know if you have it or not, but back in, I just don't want to leave this with you. This is just a, something as a chairperson. I look back to the original meeting and the information that was provided to us from the work group and the action items. And so we had VMRC to establish an appraisal work group consisting of certain aquaculture and other relevantly experienced persons to advise the agency on developing guidelines regarding the valuation of leases, compensation to leaseholders, and when leases are subject to dredging or other public uses. So, and I also looked at, recommended that VMRC establish a stakeholder group to discuss how use plans, how what use plans will entail, including how VMRC might distinguish between new entrants to the industry and veteran producers in applying use plan requirements. So they've made a differentiation there. I think it's important for us not to lose focus of our original charge. And also with the changes in the agency that we have heard about today with the shellfish division, they're looking at putting ourselves out of business, so to speak, in terms of having a shellfish management advisory committee and moving in that direction so that we can incorporate the way the agency is going to look in the future. I'm not saying tomorrow, I'm not saying in the next meeting or whatever, but let's go back to what we were originally charged to do. And if you don't have that, I'm sure I can. It's in the December 2018 report that we were all given at the first meeting. If you don't have a copy and you want a copy, staff can make it happen. But anybody have any discussion about that or feel about that?
The assessment one, I don't have any thoughts on. The new versus old industry people, a lot of that discussion centered on the renewals and lease applications. And I kind of think that's been addressed from the regulations that have been put in place that, you know, changed how transfers are. Change the rules and regulations for renewals. I think that's where those controversies first came from. So that one, I don't know if that one's still a valid one. The assessment one still may be valid.
We'll take a look at that, and maybe we can, you know, decide our next steps. You know, we've done a lot of work, but there are some still loose ends. We all agreed, if you will remember, when we were meeting face-to-face back a few months ago. I think we've met about 10 times, but the last, I made a list, the last four or five have been virtual.
Yeah.
But we were talking at one point about, you know, spending a little bit of time going over an assessment tool thought. And I think that's really something that we need to focus on maybe in the future, at least in our next meetings, is to get back to where we were when we were faced with a bigger issue, I guess is the best way to put it, with the COVID situation and other things that came along. So anybody else want to speak to that or have any ideas about it?
I think in person is a lot more
completely agree. Completely agree.
It's hard to negotiate and hard to understand. I mean, people help each other. They play off each other's thoughts. And I agree with that 100%.
And honestly, if there's a room at BMRC where we could sit around a table like this, other than us being at the dais, I prefer this setting.
This is better.
Much better.
There's a commission library behind the commission room, which is about the size of the table. We have our staff. And there's still room the public could participate.
And you could always set up the commission room if you need to.
Yeah, we can set the commission room up into a circle.
Yeah, when I was on the CRAB advisory committee, we used to have a conference table set up where the public seating area is and meet like that. So if it's not a whole lot of trouble.
Definitely don't like the theater.
So just a little bit about what Mike said, I agree. I think we definitely take care of the use requirements in the whole document. What we did talk about way back was use plans. They're not exactly the same thing. And I think at some point, once there's a shellfish division, we'll come back to that, because right now we have a questionnaire as part of the application. And we tell you it's mandatory that you fill it out. But it's not binding.
There's no teeth.
Has no teeth. And when I get calls, you know, or protests, release application that now transfers, all I can tell the people is what these people put down on the form for applications, you know, what they propose to do or not do. But here's legally what they can do after transfers. What did they do in the past? And what does the person in the future say he's going to do? Again, not enforceable. He can say no cages, and if the cages on the first day gets the lease. So I don't think we're done at BMRC with use plans. And I know industry got, you know, cringes at that a little bit, but the way I look at it from a staff perspective is we're supposed to manage this resource and assist industry as much as we can. I think we're pretty proactive with assisting industry, but it would be helpful for us and industry in the long run if we had some parameters of a use plan that are more, not really enforceable, but something more robust than we have. So I could answer those questions from the public up front instead of battling with them the whole way through the process to a hearing and, you know, maybe allay some of their fears. And it's not an overnight solution. I understand that. This would take a lot of work. But my argument in the past when we had that agriculture subcommittee or committee, whatever you want to call it, that the end result was this report to create an AMAC and some of these other issues was that, you know, this is a really complex thing we're trying to do, and it takes a lot of work to get something that's reasonable and doable and implemented.
So I'll just say what really, for those of you that weren't at the commission meeting last month, I had a renewal was denied because the commission felt like the only use of a lease was for the propagation of shellfish. That list of 10 to 15 things that this committee worked on that were acceptable reasons for using a lease was pretty much thrown out the window, I thought. So I have strong concerns moving forward with use plans if what we just outlined as acceptable uses of leases was pretty much thrown out the window by the commission last month. That they went completely on the only use for a lease is the propagation of shellfish. There was testimony from the commissioner at CBF that said they had used that lease for education within the last 10 years, it was thrown out. So I'm very nervous about what we've already worked on,
right,
even being upheld.
Well, I'll push back a little, Kim. You know, I can do that with you.
You can do that with me.
I understand where you're coming from, and I understand what the commission did. What the commission did, what they do sometimes doesn't sync with what I think I presented them. But this particular lease was huge for the Lynn Haven system. And just using it for minimal educational
purposes,
still, I didn't think met the guideline criteria of some very low parameters we've set. And so I understand it's a slippery slope. You know, I understand that term very well. And this guideline document it's a living document, and it's interpretable like anything. It's not spelled out in the law. The law does not say a bushel of pepper per acre per year. We came up with that. The law didn't really say anything.
The law says propagation of shellfish.
Right. And how do you interpret that? Was picking some groups out there for education enough on a 200 and some acre lease? How much did they really do with that? And they couldn't document it.
And I agree with that.
So
I will agree with that.
So I understand where you're coming
from. But there was no discussion of even paring that lease down. You know, that there was, it was all or none. And
I think Cap actually sort of indicated he'd take less than give it to
he did.
Blood.
He
right.
did. But
and,
my
and
concern was
that was the commission action.
Right.
I would have supported that.
Right.
I told him that. I said, look, if you ask for something less, I didn't tell him I'd support it. I said I won't oppose it from the staff.
Yeah.
It'll still be a commission decision. Of course, he turned around and applied.
That's right. He handed to you on the spot, which I thought was pretty entertaining.
I asked him if he just applied for the cut down version.
No,
no, I applied for all.
But I thought it was 85 acres.
He applied for all of it.
All of it.
I talked him into reducing it to.
I saw on the web that it's 85 acres.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Well,
so he has reduced
afterwards.
But
you came out of the area, they set aside.
No.
And
why did they set it aside?
What?
Why did they set it aside?
Part of it has piers that we would probably never lease anyway.
Okay.
And we just proffered that as this isn't there, since there are some efforts within the city and the Corps to do some more restoration projects, that particular spot would be a spot we should might want to consider just not leasing and leave it for those types of activities. It did. We should put the first thing. Somebody came in and said, we got a brand new way to raise shellfish. This is the best spot for it in the world. You know, I'll do more than any restoration project ever. So, but that was a staff. You know, we came up.
And that's where the federal funding is coming into the city, into the Army Corps, and all. Yeah, it's a whole different political
money.
But let me share with you about. I'm not supposed to talk on chair. Page 17, and if you need a copy, it talked about action items. And I just wanted us to remember, maybe go back and look at what it is the committee was supposed to assume responsibility for, even if we haven't, like, talking about, you know, the valuation of leases, compensation to leaseholders when leases are subject to dredging or other public uses. There was a big, I thought, I wasn't there on this committee, but I thought there was some concern about some compensation that was being made in order to achieve some of these political subdivision goals. And there's a question about what that should look like or how that should.
Particularly on Virginia Beach.
Exactly. So anyway, look at that page. If you don't have it,
let me know. I can resend you
the document. And maybe under new business or old business or some kind of business, next time we meet, we can talk a little bit about it. What do you think?
Ben, why don't you, could you send that in the December 2018? That's what this is. It's been a couple of years.
Right. And our first meeting, just so you remember, those of you who might not know, was April the 8th of 2019. Was the first meeting. And the people were appointed to this committee in March. So this year, coming up March, will be 2-3 years. 4 years.
Where does the time go?
It was 19, 20, 21. This would be 3 years. So anyway, and are we going to meet again? Would you prefer to wait until after, you know, when do you think then?
Well, that was going to be my next question. Well, it was a pleasure of the committee on how often we meet. Well, one, how soon do we meet again? And or how often do you want to have more of a regular meeting schedule? That's what I mean. We'll work on these changes. Regulatory Review Committee will meet again.
8, 7, something like that.
Well, I would recommend, see what y'all think about this with the holidays coming and everything, and we meet in October because.
Do we have something to discuss?
I would certainly think we should go back and look at what the charge is and how far we've come on it.
Let's see. Regulatory looks at this. How soon would you bring it back to us?
I think at this point, probably that they're going to be in October. I don't think there would be enough time to squeeze it into the October commission meeting.
Right.
So it would probably go on to December one. So SMAC is pretty busy relationships wise. That would probably make sense to have them here in October or November. If they're late October, early November would probably be able to come to.
What is the pleasure of the group? Early November?
Late October, early November, and then it's going to get too chaotic.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. We probably won't meet again until first.
Right. We'll do right after Andrew has the AMAC, the SMAC. Right?
Yeah, I would like to hear what SMAC has to say about.
So let's just say whenever he settles on a date, well, it's late October, first.
Within a week or something.
Yep.
Motion to adjourn.
I have just one question. At some point, does it make any sense? I know you guys have a lot of oyster harvesting planning.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
You got a lot of mess. It doesn't pertain to us at all. But at some point, would it be prudent to have an overlapping meeting to discuss just this issue?
We could.
And not have to set us up for an additional meeting or them up for an additional meeting or... I don't know. I'm just asking the question. I don't know if it's good or bad.
I think that's kind of the point that Beverly brought up, is there's so much overlap and sometimes half of AMAC wants to be at the SMAC meeting and sometimes half of SMAC. And I don't know how that works, other than both are welcome at each, but it's sort of
a tricky
situation. We
could do a meeting the same day and overlap. In other words, SMAC might meet October the 28th at 1 or 3 till X within the last half an hour of the meeting.
Yeah.
Y'all come in and sit in with them, then they'll leave, and then we'll continue. I mean, that's just a suggestion.
I think earlier we decided, aren't there 3 SMAC members on this committee? Or not?
Yeah.
You know that answer?
It's
Lakey. It's not AJ.
No, I think you're the only current.
I'm the only bridge.
Overlap.
Okay.
Right.
Well, I think that's a wonderful idea to have it the same day. And that way,
just have a little overlap between the close of one and the beginning of the other.
I'm all for traveling on one day. Just knock out all the meetings.
Late October, early November.
Okay.
Okay, yeah. We'll hear more about it. Motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Thank you for your time.